For a time, life and work ceased to be intolerable to the masses of the poor. This didn't, of course, prevent much individual misery and discontent. The poor we've always had with us, but this misery and discontent was divided and scattered. It became inaudible. In the earlier period, the common people had had an idea to crystallize upon, the idea of Christian communism. They had found an educated leadership in the dissentient priests and doctors of the Wycliffe type. As the movement for a revival in Christianity spent its force, as Lutheranism fell back for leadership from Jesus upon the Protestant princes, this contact and reaction of the fresher minds of the educated class upon the illiterate mass was interrupted. However numerous a downtrodden class may be, and however extreme its miseries, it'll never be able to make an effective protest until it achieves solidarity by the development of some common general idea. Educated men and men of ideas are more necessary to a popular political movement than to any other political process. A monarchy learns by ruling, and an oligarchy of any type has the education of affairs. But the common man, the peasant or toiler, has no experience in large matters and can exist politically only through the services, devotion, and guidance of educated men. The Reformation that succeeded, the Reformation that's of the princes, by breaking up educational facilities, largely destroyed the poor scholar and priest class, whose persuasion of the crowd had rendered the Reformation possible. The princes of the Protestant countries, when they seized upon the national churches, early apprehended the necessity of gripping the universities also. Their idea of education was the idea of capturing young, clever people for the service of their betters. Beyond that, they were disposed to regard education as a mischievous thing. The only way to an education, therefore, for a poor man, was through patronage. Of course, there was a parade of encouragement towards learning in all the grand monarchies, a setting up of academies and royal societies, but these benefited only a small class of subservient scholars. The church also had learnt to distrust the educated poor man. In the great aristocratic crowned republic of Britain, there was the same shrinkage of educational opportunity. Both the ancient universities, says Hammond in his account of the 18th century, were the universities of the rich. There's a passage in Macaulay describing the state and pomp of Oxford at the end of the 17th century, when her chancellor, the venerable Duke of Ormond, sat in his embroidered mantle on his throne under the painted ceiling of the Sheldonian Theatre, surrounded by hundreds of graduates robed according to their rank, while the noblest youths of England were solemnly presented to him as candidates for academical honours. The university was a power, not in the sense in which that could be said of a university like the old University of Paris, whose learning could make popes tremble, but in the sense that the university was part of the recognized machinery of aristocracy. What was true of the universities was true of the public schools. Education in England was the nursery not of a society, but of an order, not of a state, but of a race of owner-rulers. The missionary spirit had departed from education throughout Europe. To that, quite as much as to the amelioration of things by diffused prosperity, this phase of quiescence among the lower classes is to be ascribed. They had lost brains and speech, and they were fed. The community was like a pithed animal in the hands of the governing class. Moreover, there had been considerable changes in the proportions of class to class. One of the most difficult things for the historian to trace is the relative amount of the total property of the community held at any time by any particular class in that community. These things fluctuate very rapidly. The peasant wars of Europe indicate a phase of comparatively concentrated property, when large masses of people could feel themselves expropriated and at a common disadvantage, and so take mass action. This was the time of the rise and prosperity of the Fuggers and their like, a time of international finance. Then, with the vast importation of silver and gold and commodities into Europe from America, there seems to have been a restoration of a more diffused state of wealth. The poor were just as miserable as ever, but there were perhaps not so many poor, relatively, and they were broken up into a variety of types without any ideas in common. In Great Britain, the agricultural life, which had been dislocated by the confiscations of the Reformation, had settled down again into a system of tenant farming under great landowners. Side by side with the large estates, there was still, however, much common land for pasturing the beasts of the poorer villagers, and much land cultivated in strips upon communal lines. The middling sort of man, and even the poorer sort of man upon the land, were leading an endurable existence in 1700. The standard of life, the idea, that is, of what's an endurable existence, was, however, rising during the opening phase of Grand Monarchy. After a time, the process of the upward concentration of wealth seems to have been resumed. The larger landowners began to acquire and crowd out the poorer free cultivators, and the proportion of poor people and of people who felt they were leading impoverished lives increased again. The bigger men were unchallenged rulers of Great Britain, and they set themselves to enact laws, the Enclosure Acts, that practically confiscated the unenclosed and common lands, mainly for the benefit of the larger landowners. The smaller men sank to the level of wage workers upon the land over which they had once possessed rights of cultivation and pasture. The peasant in France and upon the continent generally was not so expropriated. His enemy wasn't the landlord, but the tax-gatherer. He was squeezed on his land instead of being squeezed off it. As the 18th century progressed, it's apparent in the literature of the time that what to do with the poor was again exercising men's thoughts. We find such active-minded English writers as Defoe, who lived from 1659 to 1731, and Fielding, who lived from 1707 to 1754, deeply exercised by this problem. But as yet, there's no such revival of the communistic and equalitarian ideas of primitive Christianity as distinguished the time of Wycliffe and John Huss. Protestantism, in breaking up the universal church, had, for a time, broken up the idea of a universal human solidarity. Even if the universal church of the Middle Ages had failed altogether to realize that idea, it had at any rate been the symbol of that idea. Defoe and Fielding were men of a livelier, practical imagination than Gibbon, and they realized something of the economic processes that were afoot in their time. So did Oliver Goldsmith, who lived from 1728 to 1774. His Deserted Village in 1770 is a pamphlet on enclosures disguised as a poem. But Gibbon's circumstances had never brought economic facts very vividly before his eyes. He saw the world as a struggle between barbarism and civilization, but he perceived nothing of that other struggle over which he floated, the mute, unconscious struggle of the commonalty against able, powerful, rich, and selfish men. He didn't perceive the accumulation of stresses that were presently to strain and break up all the balance of his 12 powerful though unequal kingdoms, his 3 respectable commonwealths, and their rag, tag, and bobtail of independent minor princes, reigning dukes, and so forth. Even the civil war that had begun in the British colonies in America didn't rouse him to the nearness of what we now call democracy. From what we've been saying hitherto, the reader may suppose that the squeezing of the small farmer and the peasant off the land by the great landowners, the mere grabbing of commons, and the concentration of property in the hands of a powerful, privileged, and greedy class was all that was happening to the English land in the 18th century. So we do but state the worst side of the change. Concurrently with this change of ownership, there was going on a great improvement in agriculture. There can be little doubt that the methods of cultivation pursued by the peasants, squatters, and small farmers were antiquated, wasteful, and comparatively unproductive, and that the larger private holdings and estates created by the Enclosure Acts were much more productive. One authority says 20 times more productive than the old ways. The change was perhaps a necessary one, and the evil of it was not that it was brought about, but that it was brought about so as to increase both wealth and the numbers of the poor. Its benefits were intercepted by the bigger private owners. The community was injured to the great profit of this class.